Succession, number 29956, reel 3.
Hetty Bauer, reel 3. So now you're going to tell me about the Russian Revolution.
Yes.
And the effect as I
heard about it.
That's right.
Hannah, I think it was a Friday evening because she was laying the meal to be in the dining room, as it always was on Friday evening. And she heard the newsboys shouting and went out to listen because she'd heard the name Russia, Tsars, Revolution. She was Russian in origin. She came back all excited, and I can quote because she was so much part of our family that she often called my mother, Mother, not Mrs. Rimmel. Sometimes she'd do both. Hannah could neither read or write, and I made attempts to teach her to read. I was successful in numeracy, which was a great help to her, far less successful in teaching her to read. She could recognize certain words. I don't know how old she was. She had two older sisters who had left her in the Jewish orphanage in London. They had gone to America and were hoping to send for Hannah to join them. She couldn't join them until the war ended, if she had been able to. By that time, the USA had a law that you had to be literate before you were admitted, and Hannah wasn't, so she never joined her sisters. But I was her go-between. She dictated letters to me, which I wrote for her to send to her sisters, and read the letters from her sisters to her. So in 1917, she dropped what she was doing to go out and get a newspaper to bring in for someone to tell her, but she also heard what the newsboys were shouting. The Tsarist family murdered, the Tsarist family murdered, the Russian Revolution had started, the Russian Revolution. And Hannah came back and was telling my mother, Mrs. Rimmel, Mother, the Russians have killed the Tsar and his family. And of course her recollections of the Tsar were of pogroms. Now, Hannah had one real eye and one glass eye. I didn't know that when she first came. I learned that a little later, certainly by the time my 1917. And when I first knew she had come escape from the Tsar in Russia, I thought that the Cossacks had ill-treated her and she'd lost an eye. I was convinced of that until I learned the truth. She'd had measles very, very badly, and it had affected the eye. It was nothing to do with the pogrom. But I can say that there was no sadness or horror in Hannah's telling Mother the news. It was bewilderment and what is happening, you know, that kind of thing. Now, I can't remember my father's reaction when he came home from synagogue and where they'd heard the news. He regarded the Tsar as a tyrant. I think from what I recall, There was bewilderment. How this could happen? You know, there was no television. I don't know whether Whispered Radio had started by then. You know, the little thing, what we call the whiskers, that you had to put something onto something, and then you could hear radio. What year was that first? Was it before the war ended or after World War One? I don't recall. Can't pin the year down.
Probably around that time.
We didn't have one.
No.
We didn't have a Whiskers radio. We didn't have a radio until well into the 20s. I don't know why, but we didn't.
Yeah.
But my friend who lived down the road, Fanny, they had Whiskers. But I don't remember when that, what year it was that I used to listen. No, I'm sorry, but I cannot pin the year down. But the day that the revolution started, that Friday, and it because it's so clear in my head that Hannah was beginning to lay the cutlery and so on in the big dining room. So it must have been a Friday night. You have to look up your papers for what day, what the
day
actual
the
date was in 1917. Now, how did it affect me? Not at all. I can't remember.
I was just wondering, you were saying about, you know, the Queen's Hall meeting in
that was 1922.
And then how you joined the ILP.
Yes.
And I was wondering, you know, was Russia to the... Was there a great interest in Russia at that time when you became politicised? Were you... was there sort of...
Well, I think what I remember about that in the... Because we used to meet once a week, the ILP... The Labour Party only met locally once a month, but in the ILP we met every week on a Friday, and our meeting place was in a lovely room over the Hackney Baths. I think the Photographic Society also met there one evening a week, because the pictures were all round the wall of the pictures that were selected for showing. My sister Anita and I, we were allowed to go, although it was the Sabbath. You know, the Sabbath starts the evening before the day, because it didn't require us to do anything that broke the Sabbath laws. We walked there and we walked home. My parents were Orthodox, so going on a vehicle, you didn't handle money on the Sabbath day, so you couldn't go on a bus or a train or a tram. What my father didn't know is that we carried books, which we were not supposed to do. Our library, the Hackney Library, was a wonderful store that my eldest two sisters had introduced us to. And a very kind of friend, kind of my father's from his synagogue, informed him that he had seen us emerging from the library on Saturday afternoon carrying books. So my father said, "You mustn't do that. You don't carry things on the Sabbath day. You have to go straight from school on a weekday if you want to change your books." Well, we liked meeting certain friends when we went on the Sabbath afternoon. So all we did was to deceive, because we went to Richmond Road Library, which was in South Hackney, and very few Jews lived there. And we used to hide the books. We took great care not to take too heavy tomes under our jackets, so nobody knew, and we didn't meet anybody that could inform my father. I think it was the beginning of dodging things we didn't agree with, even if they occurred, you know.
As the ILP, you know, being a member of the ILP.
Now, the ILP, as I say, we were allowed to go because we were not breaking any religious law. All we did was sit and listen. Either one week there would be a political discussion on the current news, and then the alternate week there was a speaker on a particular topic.
Well, I was wondering if this was the time, Hetty, when you became interested in anti-war, in your sort of protest against war and armaments.
Oh, yes,
you became
because a peace activist. The ILP leadership had almost all been conscientious objectors in World War One. Fenner Brockway had been in prison. He became Lord Alan of Hurtwood. Now, what was can't recall his first name.
Fenner Brockway.
His surname was Fenner Brockway. Was
yes.
Fenner.
Yeah.
Lady Alan became very much concerned in education. I don't know why they were, how they got their title. When I knew them, he was just Alan, but I can't remember his first name. But he wasn't quite as much a man of the people as Fenner was.
Yes, was it Clifford Allen?
Clifford Allen. That's it. Well, you didn't somehow call him Clifford or Cliff. He was always Comrade Allen. But Fenner encouraged one to call him by his first name. So he was all his life he was Fenner.
Mm. Would you have been a pacifist at that time?
Oh no. I wouldn't have been able to express any real understanding of pacifism in 1922. I would have said I agreed with the conscientious objectors, but that was because my father had said the war should never have happened. That was what I remembered, but it wasn't from my conscious understanding of why wars happened. That would have come during my membership of the IOP.
So this
because
sort of
the speakers that came, and what happened in Germany. The Deutschmark was completely valueless. My father's rich relative was reduced to being almost a pauper because his savings were worthless and the amount of money he had invested abroad was negligible. He did have some money because his son had insisted. His son may have been aware of that there was trouble brewing, 1912 or 1913 or whatever. And there was a small amount of money which enabled them to come to England. But I remember that the man who had been, in a sense, my father's boss, although a relative, coming to the special holiday known as Pesach at Easter time, when you had two special nights and the eldest son has to ask four questions. Why is this night different from all other nights? And you learn a potted history of what happened to the Jews when they were going to 40 years in the wilderness. No, they were in the wilderness, because we eat unleavened bread in during that week of the Passover ceremony. And I remember this elderly gentleman, white haired, white bearded, coming to have the Passover meal with my parents, because father's business, of course, had survived. I mean, that was in it, came right through World War One, through the rationing period and the post-war period. Father's business began to decline in the late 20s, I think.
But you were sort of...
But it was then my pacifism was learnt by listening to the speeches of the conscientious objectors, who were telling us why Germany had declared war, which had nothing to do with little Belgium. I then learnt of the power struggle, that the Russian soldiers who had been starving peasants prior to the war and didn't make very good soldiers as a result, got fed up with being killed and shot at and not having very good food supplies sent to them on the Russian front. And that was why they turned on their officer class, and the revolution took place. I think it was all very chaotic, what happened and what we knew of what was happening.
It's very interesting, Hetty, you telling me about, you know, actually meeting people who were conscientious objectors.
Oh, yes.
In World War One.
Oh,
what
yes.
were they telling
oh,
you?
Oh, I met. How then I became a friend for life. Mm. I knew him until he died. I used to meet his second wife in Kenwood.
How had they suffered in,
oh,
in the
Fenner,
war?
Fenner,
what did you hear about it?
Fenner was forcibly fed. Fenner had a cell 9x6 and used to walk up and down that to get exercise. Clifford Allen, I do not remember telling us much about his wartime experiences. No. Never remember Clifford Allen coming to the Hackney ILP and telling us, but Fenner did.
So they really suffered, from what you're saying. They really suffered for their belief. Is
yes.
that right?
Yes.
In World War One.
But they were treated like contempt was the word. The newspapers we used to refer to them in such a dreadful way. Men who unpatriotic. Didn't believe in, you know, supporting Britain when she needed all her men to go out and fight on her behalf and so. Well, the Kitchener slogan, with him pointing his finger at you. Have you got posters of that in the museum?
Oh yes.
Yeah. Your king and country need you. Well, it was enough to frighten the wits out of anybody to see that. And
so your pacifism was really evolving by listening to people who had taken this stance and were arguing about the reasons for war, which you had not heard before.
Oh, yes, oh, yes. Then, of course, my reading began to widen. And, of course, pamphlets were being written. The IOP produced lots of pamphlets. Ramsay MacDonald wrote a pamphlet on socialism costing one penny, which I think appeared during his Labour government of 1924, the minority government. I didn't know Reg till 1926, that might happen. But he must have acquired all the old pamphlets that the IOP still had in its store, because he certainly had that one by James Ramsay MacDonald, Why You Should Be a Socialist, One Penny.
Was it exciting when Labour won for the first time?
When
Labour won the election in 1924?
Oh, yes. Oh, God, 1922. The cheers! Because Winston Churchill lost his seat, Asquith lost his seat, all the members of the War Cabinet, if I could remember their names, many of them lost their seats, especially if they represented Scottish seats, because it was such a breakthrough for the IOPs of Scotland. And the Queen's Hall, which was in Langham Place, World War II destroyed it, because I went to prom concerts there between the wars. We were cheering the roof off. Fenner wore a pink riding habit and was up on the platform, and he used to put a hand behind, I think his hearing was affected by his wartime experiences, because I remember him doing this as he listened to the result, and then he would say, here's a good one, here's a good one, and he'd mention the constituency, and those of us that knew who had been the sitting MP, Asquith lost his seat. Cheers! We nearly took the roof off the building. Winston Churchill lost his seat. Oh! 1922 was a turning point in my life. And the next one was 1926, the miners' lockout and the general strike.
Oh, yes. Fully politicised by then, in 1926?
By 1926, I was a mature socialist and not 100% pacifist, but... how can I say? I supported you and became a member of the League of Nations, and thought that the League of Nations should be the arbiter as to whether a war was except necessary or not. But of course, the League of Nations was destined to fail from the start, because it wasn't. The media didn't support it. Most newspapers dismissed it as a talking shop of no strength in what it could or couldn't do. Of course, and there was no. International army under the League of Nations, like we want the UN to have now. I mean, that there should be a peacekeeping force under the UN in which every country of the world is represented. And when I rejoined UN about a year ago, I decided, even at my age, I had to show my support. So I rejoined. And now I am totally opposed to war, and I think the UN peacekeeping force would have to behave as a peacekeeping force, not going in to fight and kill, but to divide the sides that are fighting and killing them, making them sit down earlier rather than later to discuss what is the issue at stake, what are you killing each other for. I mean, when you get to the state that even the Muslims are killing each other, you know, there are times when I feel so depressed that I think the planet doesn't deserve to survive. And with what we're doing to the environment, we ourselves are helping that final disappearance of our planet. I mean, I'm not going to live to know what the result of the ice caps melting, the waters rushing over land. What sort of picture is this planet going to be? What are its people? Where are they going to flee? Where are we going to do if the oceans overwhelm Britain? And I don't think the young are aware of what is happening. How much time in the school curriculum today, all this talk about the national curriculum, how much time is given to citizenship, which after all is the most important thing if you are to grow up and live as a decent human being? You've got to understand what citizenship is and means, and that is the most important, I would say, the most important subject of a school's curriculum. Because without an understanding of what is happening at the moment from an ecological point of view, what is the point of learning mathematics, science, history, geography, if the world is going to disintegrate with disaster? And unless we are told now, unless we do something now, immediately, in 50 years, what is the planet going to look like? I'm not going to be here, but my great-grandchildren, if I have any, will. And I sometimes think my grandsons are so aware of this, which is why they just fight shy of becoming fathers. They're now in their mid-30s. If they're going to have children, they should now be producing their family. And they're really, really, the elder of the two grandsons has just stated categorically, I don't want the responsibility, Nana.
I must go back, because this is very interesting, but I want to follow your evolving history of, you know, becoming very involved in the anti-war movement. Yeah. And we've got to an important stage now, because you were saying you were a member of the League of Nations, but not 100% pacifist at this time.
Not to start.
But you were obviously worried about war. The feeling that war should have, if there is going to be war, perhaps I could use the word a just war. And is that how you thought of things at that time?